And off we go. Okay, this is, what is it? IB Hello. 18, I think. It's 18.
IB and 18.
IB in
Did insert you actually password. Upload IB 17?
That's the name of our podcast, Insert Password.
Insert Password.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. On so many podcasts, I can't recall which this one is.
Yeah, yeah, it's super famous. And today we have a special guest.
Yay!
Guest. It's special. Lars.
Hello, I'm Lars.
It's called Sir Lars.
Sir Lars?
Yeah.
He has that would be nice.
He's in the. Is it the order? Yeah, no. It's the order. Order of stream processor thinkers. If you are a knight, you are a part of an order, right?
No. Is it order?
The Order of the Phoenix, Harry Potter?
Yeah, good, maybe. Or is it Odor? That's like the
Geruch. Orden, der Orden der Phoenix.
Yeah, okay. Okay, yeah, then it's
Lars.
Sir. Hey,
who
sir,
are you?
Lars.
And why are you here?
Yeah, why?
Well, so I'm Lars, and I'm here because I have a nice colleague, two nice colleagues.
Yeah, he's an ex-colleague.
One nice colleague and one nice ex-colleague.
Yeah, that makes me the only one. Yay! One.
And they buffered me since like a couple of months to do a podcast about streaming. And finally I said, okay, guys, let's do it.
Yeah, let's do it. Cool.
Cool. So it's not only me who has half-baked knowledge, but we extend my half-baked knowledge with the full knowledge of Lars.
And is it now 1/4? So is it half times half?
It's about 200%, I would say. Whew. Maybe 180.
Ooh.
You put a lot of pressure on me.
yeah, cool.
So, Lars, what are you like to you have a why are you interested in stream processing? Maybe that's a better question.
Why am I interested in stream processing?
No, let's first start from the beginning. Who? What is your background? Like, we are all the same age, basically, right? 25.
25,
yeah.
Give or take.
I could be 28 by now. Or 27. 27. I'm 27.
Yeah, okay, 27. Because you want to be in the club of 27?
Under 27s, right? I need to start my heroin soon. Yeah. Otherwise, I'll probably get 28. That's a lot of bullshitting at the start.
Yeah.
That's okay.
That's what our two listeners are used to.
So we have
anyways.
Worked together.
Yeah, we have worked together now. But you guys have worked together? No.
We are still working together.
Yeah, that's what I meant. Yeah. But before we joined all in the Sony engineering cloud infrastructure thingy, we never met before. No. The three of us. We did.
Yeah.
Anyway. And you are a Scala Java developer for life, right? Kind of.
Not for life, but since my work life. University, I started with Pascal and Delphi, but then I switched to Java, and I have a little Scala knowledge, but not too much yet.
Okay.
I think that's very fortunate, actually. No one should learn Scala.
Yeah, I mean, you don't troll me with this.
Yeah,
so no, I'm just
trying to make my point. No, but so Lars knows GVM technologies quite well, right? And was in the field of also processing huge amount of data, where huge is not huge anymore, but was 10 years ago, probably.
Yeah, I would say a couple of hundreds of gigabytes was like the amount of data we had to process. And yeah, you asked me about why I'm interested in stream processing. I think it started a couple of years ago. Always had to write web services, microservices, and it was kind of boring. And I had a feeling I want some change. And then I looked very much into big data processing. So all this Hadoop stuff came up, and I just was very interested in all these kind of things. And since a couple of years, it changed. And now stream processing is the big term. So it's like the evolution from batch to stream. And so I just catched up. And now I'm mostly interested in stream processing. But also like batch processing still.
Yeah, it's a distinction we will talk about in a couple of minutes, right? Yeah. But
is there a difference?
We will know. We will, like, I think there is, but I don't know shit. So Maybe there isn't.
Probably there is.
Yeah, so... But what bored you about microservices? I mean,
microservices are okay, but if you do them all the time, it's always the same, more or less. You have a service which takes a API call, and then you, I don't know, query database and return some values, and you do that again and again. I had the feeling I want to do something more. I want to extend my knowledge.
And this, and it's by stream processing, the statefulness of stream processing is what attracts you, not that you have deterministic, distinct, and...
No, it wasn't that I went from like microservice to stream processing. It was like, okay, I don't want to just services all the time. I want to learn something, how I can process big data. And then I looked at Hadoop, and I set up a Hadoop cluster, and I looked at all these things, like how do you get data into the Hadoop cluster? How can you process it? How can you get it out? And all these things. And stream processing was just the next step. So I looked, how can I work on big data, which is in Hadoop? And so in the beginning, it was just MapReduce jobs or like cascading. And then there were new frameworks coming up, like Apache Spark or Apache Flink. They also do batch processing, but they also offer a different way of processing called stream processing. So it's the same framework which can do both. And then I got interested, okay, what is the stream processing? What is this all about? What is the difference compared to batch processing? What can I do with that? And that's just the interest started. And then I followed many talks about stream processing and just got very interested in the subject.
Okay. Yeah, then just jump right in.
I would have a question.
He has a question.
There is an evolution in standard big data processing, and big data was the term where you cannot compute the data set. I think the pragmatic definition is you cannot compute it in one machine anymore, and vertical scaling doesn't help you anymore. So you need techniques to share the data amongst many machines, and you want to have a technique where you do the processing also on many machines. The question is more or less when you mention, so I think everybody is quite familiar with the Hadoop stack and that we can use Hadoop as a compute framework, but also as a storage thing. It has kind of both aspects with its file system, with its distributed file system, and then it was also supporting something called MapReduce. And Lars was mentioning that already, but then he mentioned something else, which is called cascading. And I think cascading is a little bit different. And since I'm not really... I don't really know what it actually is,
so
but I heard
just
a lot of stuff.
A minute about the question, and the question is, what is cascading?
Yeah, but I want to also give the background why we need to distinguish between those, because MapReduce is something else than cascading, and processing is something else than both
of
the other.
Let's do it. So, what came first, cascading or MapReduce?
MapReduce.
So then let's start with MapReduce. What is MapReduce?
MapReduce is a framework to process big data, and it has, of course, now it's more complex, but in like a high-level view, you could say it has two phases, the mapping phase and the reducing phase. And in the mapping phase, you try to convert your data in a processable format, and in the reducing phase, you just build groups of data and process them in parallel to create an output. Of course, very high-level view. And the problem.
Can you repeat it again?
So MapReduce has two phases: the mapping phase and the reducing phase.
Yeah.
Mapping phase converts your data to a processable format. Reducing phase executes some logic with the groups you build in the mapping phase.
Yeah. So you say you have numbers. You say each number plus one, and at the end you aggregate.
For, let's say, I want, for example. I want to find groups of data. I don't have a good example now.
You have user lists.
The big example, which was also given, is like the word count model. So you have a text, and you split the text by white space, so you get many tokens, and then you want to compute the frequencies of the tokens.
Yeah.
But because the amount of tokens are so vast, you want to split the work. And now what you can do is basically in the map phase, you say, I group by key. So the first thing would basically every time I see the it word or token, I count the it number up.
And then it's slightly different. So let's say you have this text. Sorry, sorry to correct you.
No.
But you have this text.
No, I like that. I like that. Continue. No.
And in the map phase, you would split this text by white space, let's say. So you have single words. And then you write out the word with a count one. That's so you have a lot of tokens, every word with the count one behind it. And then you have a grouping phase. So now you group all the similar words or the same words in one group. And you have a list of the same word with the count one behind it. And then in the reduce phase, you just sum it up.
Yeah.
And then you get the count for this word.
Yeah, you have a tuple of word one.
Yeah.
And then you...
Exactly.
Aggregated but word number.
Yeah.
I'm not disagreeing. I want to just add to that, that the map comes basically... The map and the reduce are very common things in functional programming. So a mapper is always a function over a sequence, which outputs a sequence with the same number of elements in it. So, or in certain circumstances, it can have another data structure, but normally you would convert. So you have the length of the input is still the length of the output, but the input itself may change during a map phase. So going from a string or a sentence with lots of white spaces to another representation of a list of words.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Split it at a white space, we get a list of words out of one sentence. So this mapper transforms a sentence into a list of words. And then the reduce function is kind of like, a reduce function is normally a function over a sequence and an accumulator. So you pass in a collector thingy where you then do and recursively call yourself and work over it with the same function. So here it would be the add function.
Yeah.
Add the one count to the other the one count makes the two count, right? So the is then the number of two. And then once you're through that, and MapReduce in the Hadoop or Google world, it's then the pragmatic application of this pattern over a set of machines, which is the Hadoop cluster.
Yeah.
And that gives you the ability to parallelize over the amount of machines, the workload that you have on top of the data that you already stored on the nodes.
And the reduce step is multi-staged. So you could have a tree. So first you have four nodes.
It's a directly acyclic graph, which we will probably talk about when we come to Flink and Spark. So there's a execution graph that goes, you need to do this. And then when you define a MapReduce job, you also give the number of parallelism for mappers. You give the number of parallelism for reducers. And then you have something called shuffle, where you randomize the data to make every machine hopefully equally busy.
Yeah.
And that's the shuffle phase. And then you get eventually to the result. But there was so this is basically a compute model on top of data stored in a cluster.
Yeah.
And what is cascading? Because I don't know what cascading is. So in Hadoop, we would still use files, I guess, sequence files that we store data in.
So just two things I want to add. So the shuffle phase is between the map and the reduce phase.
Yeah.
And it does the grouping for you. And in the end, it guarantees you that tuples with the same key end up on the same node for processing in the reduce phase.
So it actually does not really random shuffle, but it does more partitioning.
Yeah, it does more partitioning.
So it's a badly named function.
Exactly.
Okay.
And the second thing, so you can define the amount of reducers what you want to have, but you can not define the amount of mappers because the amount of mappers depends on your input data. So what MapReduce does, a folder with like 100 of files inside, and you want to execute a MapReduce job on them. So it reads this folder and it knows how can I split it. And then of course it depends on what format does the data have. Is it like a gzip or is it afro? They have different MapReduce has to split up this data into small chunks to pass it to the mappers, and depends on the input format how you can split it up. And so it's always important to have an input format which is splittable, like for example afro or parquet, because then it doesn't matter if it's one file or 100 file. MapReduce can just read it and can create as many small chunks as it wants and create as many mappers as it wants to process this data.
But if you have, for example, if we have a JSON blob which goes JSON open and JSON end, and with then there is a list of a million items,
yeah,
then it can only create one mapper.
Yes, yes. Oh, yeah. Or if you have a gzip file, can by default it cannot be splitted by MapReduce. So you have a gzip file, it will end up in one mapper. So that's always, you have to think, how, what is the format of my input data? That has a huge, huge impact on the parallelism of the MapReduce job. Okay, but so coming back, the problem is with MapReduce jobs that they can do one thing. You know, you like convert your data and then you do some processing on it. And what happened in the past, that for many problems you want to solve, you need multiple MapReduce jobs. So the output of your first MapReduce job is the input for the second MapReduce job. And the output of the second MapReduce job is the input for the third, because you just had more complex things to solve. And so people ended up in writing a lot of MapReduce jobs and somehow coordinated that, okay, this is the output folder from the first one. Now it has to be the input folder for the second one, and so on. So it got very complicated. And I think that's why they came up with cascading, because cascading, in the end, it creates MapReduce jobs for you, but it provides you an API which lets you define your workflow. And you don't have to take care about a single MapReduce job anymore, but you just say, okay, this is my data. I want to process it that way. I have some grouping functions and some filter functions and so on. And under the hood, cascading will translate your input queries into a chain of MapReduce jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just more comfortable to use and to define your queries.
But it's still, it's just coordinating the...
Yeah.
It will also write out the MapReduce job, or will it pick from a pool of already written MapReduce jobs? Like, I don't know, there's always a standard aggregator, or there's always a standard splitter program, or there's always this and that. Pre-configured.
Yeah, probably. I don't know exactly, but I think it has some pre-configured MapReduce jobs and will just, yeah, probably that it must be like that, and will create just a chain of those jobs, and they are pre-configured jobs.
Okay, so it makes the hassle of like expressing your problem in terms of MapReduce functions easier, because it uses a higher level kind of.
But you still write Java.
You still write Java.
You could do all. You could have always, with every Java API, you can use the interop of a good language.
Yeah, I know what's coming.
No, I'm not saying that. But interestingly, because I'm just looking at the contributor list of cascading, there's this guy called Nathan Maas.
Okay.
And he was in a company called Backtype, which eventually got bought by Twitter 10 years ago or something. And that company implemented the trending topic feature for Twitter using the first stream processor ever out there called Storm.
Storm.
And so Nathan Maas also wrote a book called Big Data.
So, and now we have cascading, which is just an abstraction. I just ignore Hagen.
That's very unpolite.
But that's how it, how
yeah,
we,
this
how
is
we
how our marriage works.
And what is next then?
Love in the marriage. That was the bridge basically for stream processing.
But isn't it more like batching first?
So if you look at cascading, or if you look at MapReduce, you have two problems. First of all, how do you express my jobs? And the second one is the runtime. How long does it take to execute your job? So with cascading, you solve the first problem. You can express your job in a better way. I must say, it still has a lot of issues, but it's much better than plain MapReduce. But I used it for like 2 years, and I was struggling a lot, but it is definitely better than plain MapReduce. But you still have the issue with the execution, because in the end, it's MapReduce jobs, so you have the same performance like with MapReduce.
And the problem with MapReduce is that it's writing to HDFS and reading from HDFS?
MapReduce is slow. It's very stable and it can really work on huge amount of data, but it is slow because it always syncs everything to HDFS. So it has a lot of disk I/O all the time for every step, and it is just slow.
Okay.
Yeah, normally you would have a configuration where I think even the default is replication of 3, right? So an acknowledged write would actually take 3 disk hits, and the read will be a little bit faster. But you still Yeah, you just hit the disk, and every time you see this, like the if you go a cycle of a CPU is a second, then hitting the disk is basically the distance of a light year or something.
Yeah.
Right. So if your computing relies on like the fastest way you can compute is now the slowest thing you have in your infrastructure, that's the hard disk drive, then yeah, it will be slow.
Yeah.
But it will be always secure, right? And kind of like if you believe in F-sync, then you kind of you are very safe.
Yeah, and you can always start a step again because it's always written to disk.
Right.
Yeah.
It always can crash, go nuts and do something else, but it always knows, this is the next line I have to read. And because it's the next line. To understand this, so a file in HDFS would normally be written line by line by line in different formats called sequence files. And in that sequence, so meaning line by line by line, this is a sequence file. Now, if a line is read out, the line is removed from the file.
Yeah.
And then you can just move on. And so is your result. It's also a line-wise file. And so you can go ahead and do this. So even if a chain of MapReduce jobs crashes, it's quite easy, programmatically easy, to recover from the position where you have been.
And so that's where batch processing comes in, right? So each MapReducer job is a batch.
Yeah.
And even within this batch, each file line is a micro batch.
Yeah, you could say so, yeah. So you have a batch after the mapping phase and then after the reducing phase, and then the next job picks it up, and you have this chain of batches.
Yeah.
And that's how MapReduce works. Yeah, just a lot of disk IO and batches all the time and syncing with the file system after every step.
Yeah.
And it makes it very reliable but also very slow.
But if you have very compute heavy map steps, then that's fine, right? Because the amount of compute you have to do for every line is pretty heavy, then the syncing to disk maybe is not a problem because it's more...
that's not, but still you have to sync it. So you don't have, if I'm not mistaken, you don't have the option to not sync it to the disk. So of course, if you have to compute some difficult stuff, then that's not the issue. The issue is always the syncing to HDFS.
But the other problem is that normally if you want, like when you think of the HPC world where you come from, the cycles that you burn are most often against a huge state or against a huge model. And then everything is already shared in memory. And that's completely like MapReduce never makes advantages of big heaps or big memory it has. It's like you cannot even build up this like the global state of your compute weather model in memory and then say, yeah, I have everything in memory now and I bang on it really fast. That's not how MapReduce works. It will still go in the next phase and says, where's my input file for the weather from North America? It's there. And where's my front from Europe? Oh, it's there. Oh, let me map it. And then, the limitation is basically it's very slow.
Yeah.
But is it because Hadoop is always afraid of being killed? I mean, the notion of the nodes you need for Hadoop is it's very commodity hardware. You only have gigabit and you are not overloading the system with 100% load. You always try to be in like only 70% utilization. So you assume within the framework, as far as I understand it, that everything is brittle and it can crash. So that's maybe why they always say, okay, let's sync it. Let's be safe. Better safe than sorry. And wasn't it used also more for this batch jobs during the night that aggregates logs?
Yeah.
So it was more getting shit done and not being super fast?
Exactly. I think when they created MapReduce, they had not in mind they want some fast processing framework. They just wanted to somehow handle a huge amount of data in a reliable way. That was the intention. And like you said, I think they had really a lot of jobs running during night or even for a couple of days to like process some data which was not like time critical.
So it's more, it should be done sometime, but And it should, when it crashes, should start one where it left off and
exactly.
Not
so if
do
you have a crash
again.
And you manage your MapReduce jobs in a good way, then you can just like step in and from the last file sync and just continue your job. You don't have to like start from beginning because you have everything on HDFS available.
Yeah. Okay, cool. But then someone got bored and said, yeah, no, I don't like this. Let's do something else.
No, I think the assumptions were not true anymore. So when Google came up with this idea, it wanted to not spend all its money in expensive hardware. And it wanted to also like build a huge world-spinning compute cluster. And it so it was done for commodity hardware, and it was done basically for data that doesn't need, like the search index was always quite important and the index itself has to be reliable, but to build the newest search index for the web in the 1990s or early 2000s, it was not very important to be very fast at building the index.
No.
It still had time for several hours or even a day to come up with the newest ranking, but then the search needed to be fast. And so it served, the whole pattern served, I think, Google very well in the beginning of the company itself and in the beginning of search for the World Wide Web. But then eventually new techniques, new hardware, new problems you can solve led to another. I think really the bridge here is like why Twitter bought Backtype for computing worldwide trending topics in real time or almost real time. They wanted to be able to, with a news cycle, to compete in terms of speed, to see what's going on among all its Twitter users. And to do that, MapReduce was not fast enough anymore.
And people tried to solve, there was a time when people tried to solve everything with MapReduce because it was just new and cool. For example, graph processing or machine learning. And there are some libraries. I remember there's a library called Giraffe for Hadoop, which does graph processing. And of course, they brought some benefits, but in the end, they always were bound to this MapReduce paradigm. Sorry. and this just did not fit to everything what they wanted to do. And then people came up with like, okay, for finding some new technologies, how to do graph processing, machine learning, stream processing, how to do these things, because MapReduce was just not made for that. For some time, people tried to still like use it in a way that it fits, but a lot of problems came out of that, and then some technologies evolved.
Yeah, I mean, you can imagine that graph processing, if you have every node as a file and you cannot build a memory model of the graph, sounds not too performant.
Machine learning is like a typical use case that you learn in cycles. So this is the best case, like the output of your first cycle is the input for the next cycle. And then you go on and go on and your data gets better and better. And that's the problem. What we have, like the output of one job is the input for the next jobs. How do I do that? What cascading tried to solve a bit, but in the end was still MapReduce jobs, and you had the performance issues.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So what was the first stream processor then?
I think the first one was Storm.
So we went straight from batch to stream, or there's something in between, like batch micro-batching? I mean, what differentiates batch from stream?
I mean, so the problems with MapReduce we had with cascading, improving some of it, and the coordinating of the jobs. Then there is this notion where you have this data set, right? Google started with basically crawling the web, and the crawler was never stopping, but it was always kind of giving them a volume for a day, basically. There is these new web crawl data, and it's a data set now. And in Hadoop, everything is a finite, like an ending. Like a data set has a start, it's line zero. And then on the splitted files, it has somewhere the latest line or the end line of a data set. Somewhat, these data sets were bounded. They had a start and an end.
Yeah.
And if you do this, you can split them into batches because you know this is zero and this is my offset, and then you go until you finish the end. And this is your amount of batches you can create of this bounded data set.
Yeah. And so let's say it's a log file or it's log files. Yeah, yeah. Then you have days and you could say,
yeah,
I batch per day.
It's bounded. And now when we talk about Spark or Flink, I would say there is nothing in between because the Storm processor, Storm stream processor, didn't have the notion of really batch or continuous streaming. It would do mini batching in the end. And for like what it did was actually mini batching. It was trying to fit 100 things into one step, feed it into what was called a spout, like the input for topology, which was a topology was a directed acyclic graph of computation. And then it would run this mini batch across this topology, and eventually the last bolt, the last compute unit, would basically store it somewhere. I don't know if the bolt was actually the last one, but now then with tweets,
the direct acyclic graph is just so there are no loops within the graph, so that it cannot feed itself.
There might be recursion actually. You might call yourself again, but like from the logic of bolts, you don't build a cycle in here.
Yeah.
But and there might be like the data might go into cycles actually. I think that was possible in Storm.
I mean, direct is that you cannot go back. So like you have one direction. So you cannot like if you have operator one is connected to operator two, then you can only go from one to two and not from two to one. That means direct, and acyclic is that you don't have circles in the end. Yeah. But you could have some computation circles, I think.
Storm had some weird things that you could like. Imagine you have a nested data structure or a nested set JSON blob. You go and extract one thing, but that one thing would still be nested. You could send it back again to the same thingy and would split it. Something like that would be possible. Then the data would circle across the bolts, but the computation not.
Right, and it would be different data. It would be, you would create more data from one data blob or data point.
Yeah. And Twitter was basically then saying, you know what, our tweets, and they were always talking about that, they called all their tweets one fire hose. And there was the first instantiation where people were talking, this is a fire hose of data. And that basically means it never ends. So this is the first thing where we talk about an unbounded data set. Mm-hmm. And how to compute now over an unbounded data set, that's basically streaming data. Yep. We stream forever going. It once started and it never ends, and we're still computing over the unbounded data set. And now how to do that? And then I don't know if so. Spark was then basically, I don't know how Spark actually started out, but somehow they were also they were first maybe a batch processor.
Yeah. So Spark started as a batch processor. So they wanted. So they wanted to solve two issues. They wanted to solve the API issue, what also Cascading did, but they also wanted to solve the performance issue. But they still, the core of Spark is a batch processor, just very optimized, works a lot with in-memory stuff, and is very fast. But the core is a batch processor. And at some point, they noticed, okay, stream processing is coming more and more important. We should do something about it. And then they tried to use their batch processing core engine also for stream processing, and they did it in creating micro batches. So, a micro batch is a batch of, let's say, a second or 500 milliseconds, but it's still doing all the batch processing just in very small batches. And then it feels like stream processing.
So a batch is not now anymore a number of lines on a sequential file, but it's now a time window in which data arrives and will be accumulated and then passed forward to the next computational step.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. It's a Sheeta version of stream processing.
Yeah, in the end it is. And because the stream processor has now a lot of, or real stream processors can offer a lot of cool features, they cannot really do that with this micro batching approach. And I know they try to rework some things called structured streaming, but I don't know what is the state of that. But so don't understand me wrong. Spark is still a good stream processor for many things, but there are limitations at some point. Then you should not look at Spark for stream processing. But something else I want to say, what's very interesting, like if you think about batches and about streams, so a batch, like it's always like a bounded data set, but a stream is an unbounded data set or unbounded data. And if you think about reality, like how life works, how data is flowing in the internet or everywhere, it's always, there is no start and there is no end. There's like data all the time, 24 hours, every day, we got new data from somewhere. And the nice thing about the stream processor is that it really tries to fit to reality.
It's nice.
It tries to handle the data as it is and not with some artificial boundaries. And that's a
Because cool if you create batches and you have bounded data, you have to define what the boundary is, right?
Yes.
Is it a file or is it time or is it space or is it something?
Exactly.
And with unbounded, you just don't make any assumptions and any categorizations.
Of course, there are a lot of challenges involved to do that, but it's just from the thinking. It's really like the reality is. It's not that we create something and say, okay, we want only the data for Monday to Friday from 6 to 8 or something like that, but we really take everything. We don't have this artificial borders.
Yeah. Yeah, true. So you have a guy that's like in a row of getting buckets of water from one to the other, and he's just handling it and pushing it forward and not looking, oh, what kind of bucket is it? I would just throw it to the next guy. I don't care. It's just make it as fast as possible. Yeah. And did you have in the beginning the notion of event time, processing time, or is it something that, I mean... Or is it something new?
I just want to go back because architecture-wise, when Twitter started with Storm, they were talking about something called the Lambda architecture, which was, I think, also not well-named thingy, but it basically refers to historic data will be stored in our long-term storage system and will be computed on these big batch cycles, 24 hours, 12 hours, whatever, and then they create results or what was also... they give them the name of views. And then the stream for, say, actual topics that go through and for computing the trending topic was called the another data path in that architecture, and that was the real-time view. And then the batch processing view was basically merged with the real processing view and would give the end result. So you could say that in the last 5 hours we have seen Bundesliga, it was the most important hashtag, but in the last 24 hours, I don't know, Munich was also a very popular hashtag. And then you can take the 24-hour and older computation from the batch and get that number and get the latest numbers from the stream processor. So architecture-wise, there were these two data paths where you had to build out your computational logic in two different things. One was the still MapReduce, and the other one was basically a stream processor kind of application. And then Spark also helped, and Flink, to unify that. You would write one program in one language that fits both paradigms, and you don't duplicate your business logic.
But this Lambda architecture was the stream processor path was more an approximation of what is going to be the batch results.
Exactly, because
there was the batch results was saying, whatever, this is the actual result. It's like the forecast for a government poll, and then at the end, the official result.
Yeah, because there was a big problem in the first stream processors, and it's still actually now, it's exactly once. So there will be duplicates in the data or missing data. And so if you do a simple sum of anything, you might be off or wrong, basically, because you don't know if you lost data frames or you had too much of them, and then you were counting twice or multiple times, actually. And so, it was always an estimate. And that it was not easy to solve, basically, for a stream processor. But when we think about... So this was the architecture change. And then for... what we have now, we basically say we have one source of data which is endlessly streaming towards us, and now we have to deal with time and what goes into a unit of computation. We define time windows over the streaming data, And now it's important to distinguish between these two times that we know of. One would be the time when we actually do something with the data, the processing time, and another time would be the event time, which refers to the time when the data was actually created. So you can think of somebody as tweeting in a plane,
yeah,
but he is offline and only 6 hours later he will arrive at his destiny, and then this tweet gets sent out.
Destination?
It's not destination?
Destiny. You said, destiny. But anyway. Anyway. No.
We got you.
No, but
destiny.
Okay.
Destiny?
Destiny is your... It's anyway.
Yeah, I'm incapable
but maybe,
of
but,
English.
But make,
before... Okay, like processing time, event time. I think... Yeah, sorry that I mentioned it before, but I would like to talk about something else before. So batch processing can try to cheat and be... And try to mimic a stream processor, but at the end, a stream processor is a better batch processor, right? So you can... If you have a very cool stream processor with exactly once and everything fine, then this guy will beat every batch processor because it's just superior. It's just a better technique. Or is it... Or is it... Oh.
I think time will tell.
Scratching.
Yeah, actually. It's yeah, it's like, so it's near real time, right? You are faster and you get more throughput and you can build out more state in memory.
But if you create a window over a stream processor, isn't then a batch processor then?
Yeah, but I have not seen yet or heard of something. So the MapReduce gives you the ability to compute over petabytes of data an exact result with 100% guarantee that even if 25% of your infrastructure goes haywire, you'll still be able to compute the result. And I have not seen this yet with a stream processor. So
okay. They're
like in a certain scale, I don't know if that still is the advantage. It certainly is to what we see currently, like a normal, I don't know, terabyte day of log data. That's easy for modern stream processors. But is it also with 10 years worth of 1 terabyte per day?
Yeah. Okay, so
I think, yeah, really the future will definitely goes into that direction, that we can keep all the state in the stream processor and we don't need batch processing anymore, but I would not...
It's
I
too harsh.
Rely on that right now.
It's very strong to write to files. It's a very strong... Like, there's something very strong.
It's a very conservative approach,
yeah,
and it's a proven conservative approach,
yeah,
to sync everything and have little steps and have little batches instead of one stream.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, got it. Okay, sorry. But yeah...
How long are we in, actually?
I wanted to say something
45
about
minutes.
The time windows. And so just to make that clear, so we have now this stream of unbound data, but we still want to do operations on the stream. So if we only want to look at a single data point, then that is very easy. You just have a function which looks at a single data point. But if you want to have more like aggregations, like what happened the last 5 minutes or something like that, then you need those windows, which are basically snapshots of your stream, right? And it doesn't need to be a time window. It could be also a count window. It really depends on what are like the criteria for your window. But in the end, you define a snapshot of your current stream, and you want to process the data within this snapshot, depending on your business logic. And they are different. They're like, for example, we have tumbling windows, like they tumble over your stream, which means that each data point exactly belongs to one window. So you could have a tumbling window of 5 minutes. So 5 minutes, you have all the data, then next 5 minutes, and so on.
Yeah, so as an example, you have log files and you have a timestamp in the log file and you want to have exactly the 5 minutes, like, or this
and
hour.
Yeah, and this is also the interesting point. How do you assign your data points to this window? So if you use processing time, then it's the time when the data arrives in your stream processor. But you can just think about it like, if you want to reprocess your data, everything will be different because you always use the processing time. You don't have any like really guarantees. And if you use event time, then you always have the time of the event. You extract the timestamp from the event and use this as the timestamp in the stream processor. So it's reproducible. It's like accurate. That's why you should always use event time if it's possible for you, because it gives you much more quality for your data. And there was this like sliding windows when you have like a 5 minute window and you slide over it every minute, let's say. So then the data point can belong to more than one window. And then you can do the same with counts. There are also session windows. Like you can try to detect user sessions. You think about, you have a stream and you partition your stream by user ID. So for every user, you have a small stream. And now you want to see if this user is active. So usually if a user is on your web page, he will just click something. And for every click or every interaction he does, we will create a data event.
Yep.
And then you could say, okay, if I don't get a new data point for this user for 10 minutes or 15 minutes, then I consider his session is done because he does not send me any new data.
Yeah, and it's ended with the last action or is ended with the 10 minutes timeout?
So you could say it can do both. You can say, okay, if he logs out, you get a logout action for this user, okay. Then you know he's not there anymore. Or you can say, if I don't get anything because he just left the web page and he just did not send me the signal that the session is over, then you can define a timeout, which makes sense for this business case. And then you still know, okay, probably for this user, I will not get anything anymore. And now I have a computation window for this user with all this, everything what he did in the session, and I can do something with it. So yeah. It's very different possibilities how you can define windows on your stream. And it always depends on the business case.
Yeah, that's the answer for everything. Yeah. Always depends. Okay. So we talked about Spark, Storm. What else?
Yeah, we talked. We are not holding to our A block, but I would like, giving the time we went, I would say that we just skip forward and get some information about Flink out of Lars' head.
And but what the transaction thingy here? How
I mean, the point is that it's very hard to do asset safe transactions, right? To really like there's a lot of conversations how you would turn a database inside out was one title of a talk where somebody said that if you have an append log, right, you have a file structure where you just the latest line of your file. Or the newest line of your file, depending on how you arrange it, is the last thing that you have seen in your data thing. Then you can have, and you call this an append log. And this is strictly ordered. And if you have these ordering guarantees, it's basically what a database system, a normal SQL database system, would do when it does writes and reads. It will do, or when it applies updates to the data, it will always have a transaction log. And the first thing that happens in the database system is writing to an append log. And
yeah, this is called write ahead log, right?
Let's stick with append log because it's the official term in the Kafka documentation. I wouldn't like the it's similar, but then they use explicitly that term. And when you have that, you can always get to a certain state at a certain time by just rereading the append log in sequence and apply all this modification that are in that append log to get to your state. And that's a very strong pattern of building out a state or know where you are. And stream processors were not... And to have a transaction, you would basically say, aha, did I go to the end of my transaction? No, I don't. And my transaction just failed. Then you need to do also a rollback. And to do the rollback, you basically reread from the transaction log before you started your own transaction, and you get to the state before you try to change anything in your database. And that makes the database actually consistent. What it does is it basically gives you... It does that at the cost of availability, because if you can basically make a database stuck by locking it into continuous rollbacks, it always tries to recreate the least consistent state it knows. And by doing so, you can stuck it completely and make it completely unavailable, which is not something you want to have for a live system, for instance. But you can think of a stream processor in the same way as a database. You will basically throw all your data in, and then at some point you want to get views out of it, you want to do computation over your data. So a stream processor can be seen as a database, but then how is transaction handled? How do you know that everything you did is let's go over it. Acid, atomic,
coherent,
consistent, isolated, and durable. So how to achieve these four attributes in your stream processor? And that was not so easy. And there are currently, to my knowledge, only two systems that promise now to be able to do this. One is the latest Kafka Stream API with transaction enabled in the Kafka 1 version. Mm-hmm. And Flink was a little bit faster in that, I think. They have 1 year. They say they are transaction safe. So no, they don't say they are transactions. They say they have exactly once delivery semantics. And that's a quite different.
They say that since a long time, I think, but it really depends. I can explain later how that works. So you cannot say in general Flink is exactly once. It always depends on some things.
Yeah. And I think what Kafka also does, it's saying we have built transaction in Kafka, but they are not referring to a real asset thing here, because it depends on how you chain your data processing. And that's, I mean, maybe we can just...
But if you have at least once, then you can roll back transactions. So if you say in your stream, now I begin transaction A, and then you do some stuff, and at the end you say I finish transaction A or I roll back transaction A, then you can do that, right?
But when you at least once will actually say there will be duplication of your data.
Yeah.
And if you think now of a cluster that computes with 50 nodes, how do you know where to find your duplicates to roll back, to clean out your data step?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the delivery semantics are one thing, and the other thing is like really be able to be consistent, isolated. I mean, durable is kind of given, but like making the changes in an isolated way is also like how, like you count, I sent you $500 and I also owe Lars $500, and in the meantime I will get someone else to give me $500. Am I like, where's the state where I'm giving you $500? I don't have any $500, and when can I give $500 to Lars?
Yeah.
I can basically only give him the 500 once I before received the 500 myself.
Yeah.
And so and there is a point isolated in time where I pay you out, but I can't pay Lars out. But there might be a buggy system where I have nothing. Somebody knows I will get 500 and already gives them to Lars, and it would be fine, and nobody will notice that I was bankrupt in between.
Yeah, so the money in the system is not stable.
Yeah, that's called banking system.
Yeah.
But yeah, so they would actually like that. But yeah, so there's a notion between delivery semantics and asset transaction safetiness. But let's skip at least the last point, event sourcing or the stream processing.
Yeah, okay.
We will have another day with Lars.
Yeah. Okay. Then let's talk about Flink, baby.
Ah, that song.
That's nice. Song.
See, now we know that Christian is not 25.
Okay, yeah, that was a clue. So not too much laughing because I still have my nose somehow. Okay,
we want to talk about that first. You cannot laugh.
No, it's...
You should not tell me then.
No.
Now I have to try
Flink,
harder.
Flink. Talk about Flink.
Why is it running on Hadoop, Lars?
Lars, why? Hadoop sucks.
It doesn't need to run on Hadoop, but it can run on Hadoop.
Oh.
Hey, that sounds better.
Yeah, continue. We are getting somewhere.
Maybe we should... So, because today, before you invited me, I looked at the Flink homepage to say what Flink is.
And okay.
They say, okay, Apache Flink is an open source stream processing framework for distributed, high-performing, always available, and accurate data streaming applications.
So accurate means accurate, yeah, or whatever that English word is called.
The A1.
They refer to their ability to do exactly one semantics.
I think so. So distributed. So I thought I'd just go over these four terms quickly. So distributed means that you have multiple, call it task manager. So, or let's start with that. So Flink always has one job manager. It's like the master, and then it has a number of task managers. And each task manager can have several workers, and they perform the actual work. These are the slaves, and they have some slots. So distributed means that you have a lot of task managers with a lot of workers, and you can scale up, and they work different hardware. That's the distributed part. Always available. So if one worker fails or one task manager fails, the job manager notices this and can restart the task manager on a different node, for example. But this always has also to play together with the orchestrator. So this depends, does Flink run on Hadoop, or does it run on Mesos? Or I think they also have something with Kubernetes, but I'm not so sure about that. It did not really follow everything in the last 6 months. But they also have container approaches, so they can also run Docker. But for like always available, so if a task manager fails, Flink job manager will bring up a new task manager.
And the state of the job is stored in the job manager or in the task manager?
Each task manager has a local state, but the state is also backed up by a distributed file system, usually HDFS or S3. So they can recreate the state on a different node.
Available. And the last checkpoint is known by the job manager and the task manager.
Yeah, exactly. So this is the how it's accurate with this checkpointing mechanism they have. They can guarantee you that they can recover from every checkpoint. Yeah. That's also how exactly Vanzinter works. But I can say something about that. And the job manager itself can also fail because there are some passive job managers, and they notice that the one fails, then they use Zookeeper. So that means always available, then high performing. I would say you can scale up. So if you don't have state, you can scale up without any problems. If you have state, then you have to think a bit, how do I work with the state? How do I partition it? Because like the partitioning can always be a factor to limit your scaling. Just think about Kafka, for example. If you have a topic with 10 partitions, so you can only have 10 active consumer threads. You have like 15 or 20, the other ones will be idle. And the same if you work with like state, usually you partition your data in a stream processor to have all the data for one user in one partition, for example, or whatever your partition key is. And if you have a partition key which is not very smart, I don't know, something which like limits your scalability, then you can only have as many parallel streams as your partition key will give you.
And the state, just so that I understand it, so let's say you have a click stream and you count the clicks per user, and this is your state.
Yeah.
So you have like Horst, it clicked two times, and then you partition it by the first character of the user, and since normal German names, everyone is Horst, so Horst and Hans and Helmut, so everyone starts with an H, so that's stupid. Maybe you should do a hash and then store it like that.
So is it stupid?
I don't know.
If you I think what the interesting part is, like the partition key also depends on your problem.
Yes.
Because if you actually know that there is a distribution behind your data, then you want to work against that. Most of the time, your goal is to utilize your infrastructure as best as possible. And you want to have an even distribution of the compute problem across all your hardware nodes.
Yeah, this is shoveling in MapReduce.
Everybody should participate in solving the problem at hand.
It's communism.
But then there is something where you say, I have this power law distribution where a few or the majority of my data set has this feature. Like the name states starts with H, and then maybe you have your infrastructure be able to leverage that and say this things, because it's so important to me, go always to this new hardware which has the superpower CPUs and the super memory, and then therefore you want to like follow your input data set distribution in terms of items per slot, but maybe you don't. So the partition key is really key to also distribute the work across the cluster. But my question was also, how do you get the data into Flink? Will you always, like, is it said and done that everything will be Kafka up front, or is it kind of like, no, whatever, there's an input connector somewhere you can read off of whatever you like?
Yeah, so Flink, Flink job usually looks like that. You have source or multiple sources.
But can we still, this partitioning thing, I don't understand. I mean,
damn.
Shouldn't it be evenly distributed no matter what? Because if it's evenly distributed, then you will just put five partitions on the same host if it's more beefy.
Yeah, but if your use case, so let's say you want to count all the users by their first letter. Like you want all the users. So then you have, I don't know how many letters has the alphabet.
24, 25, 26, give or take.
Let's say five.
Let's say five. So then you have five partitions, right?
Yeah.
And even if you now have like 100 workers, it doesn't help you. You have five partitions because your business case needs to count this. So if you want to do that, you cannot, cannot scale. So the partition key always limits the way how you can scale.
So for instance, if you partition according to the geodata information, then you can have a job that says, give me all the Berlin data, and he knows from which partition.
And then you have another job, give me the rest of Germany, right? Because everybody has a bad internet connection, and it's less likely that you get even data out of anything else than Berlin. So your cluster will be busy computing everything Berlin, and this one node will get the rest of Germany computed because it's so less data. And then you, like, because this fits your problem you want to solve way better in terms of utilizing and do what you...
And this partition definitions you can come up with yourself. You say, this is Berlin, this is Dortmund, this is Hamburg.
Yeah, the problem is if you don't
come... This is where the rest goes.
Most of the time people don't come up with their numbers here, and then they get totally screwed, and then they need very expensive consultancies. That's the last part of our section C, while we are not millionaires yet. It's like, you put your data in these buckets and now you cannot compute anymore and you cannot scale any further because you did a boo-ha in not thinking about your problem. You should always revisit how your data patterns change, and they will change once a company grows or even shrinks, and then there will be different demands and other things make more sense than you started out with.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Makes sense. Okay. Sorry, but what did you talk about?
We were at Flink somehow.
Distributed, high performing. Yeah, and accurate. Accurate is exactly once. So, and you asked me about how the data gets into Flink.
Yeah.
True.
So, Flink job always has one or multiple sources. Then it has a bunch of operators. An operator could be a map, filter, group by, and all this. You can do on the stream, and then you have one or multiple things. So, and the source, for example, they have a Kafka source, they have an HDFS source, they have
CSV RabbitMQ file is still common, I heard.
Yeah, RabbitMQ source. I don't remember all.
But
they have
a bunch of connectors to different sources, and the same is for the things. So they can write to HDFS, they can write Kafka again to Elasticsearch, Redis. And about exactly one, so the operators, they all participate in this exactly one process, but the source and the sync, they also have to participate in that. Because just think about, you read data from Kafka, then you, I don't know, you filter it, map it, group it, and then you want to write it to a relational database. Now, if you do that, and at some point, one more thing, and then Flink has this checkpoint. So every data elements, it sends a checkpoint request to the operators, and then each operator will checkpoint its current state. And checkpoint means it will write it to a local state. It's also then backed up by a distributed state. But the operator knows, this was my state at the last checkpoint, and the last checkpoint was this message. And if all the operators now committed this checkpoint, that they successfully processed it, then if you have in the future an error, you can turn back to this checkpoint. So each operator will knows what was the last message it got. So it recreates its local state. And then it must reprocess all the messages after its committed last message. Mm. In Kafka, you can do that because you can reset the offset and then you can consume everything again.
So it depends on your input.
Yeah, for example, with RabbitMQ, you could not do that because RabbitMQ, if you get your message once and then RabbitMQ doesn't know anything about it.
Yeah, so what? So you got it already. So
yeah, you cannot tell RabbitMQ, give me this message again. Yeah. That's why always you're like your sync, in this case, Kafka.
Source
has to participate in this checkpointing and also the sync if you want to have end-to-end exactly once. So for example, with a relational database, you could do that if you have a smart primary key for your data, because if you had it twice, then you just ignore it. Or with Elasticsearch, you could have an document ID also have exactly once. Flink also has a special HDFS sync, then they also checkpoint the HDFS state, and then if you have a crash and you turn back to the last checkpoint, then they would remove everything what was after the last checkpoint from the HDFS. You can process it again and have it exactly once. But and also with Kafka, I think it's not yet, but Kafka supports these transactions now.
Yeah. So you can have a producer. Yeah, I don't know if they can make it work. The way I understand the transactions, the consumer side they do something similar to checkpoints, but I don't have.
Yeah, I just read in a blog or somewhere that they're working on Kafka Sync, which also is now exactly once.
They yes,
can leverage this,
that would
this
be possible because
transaction ID.
Yeah, they call it they call it a special producer.
Yeah,
and this producer will basically creates an idempotent ID as a key. And then when it has to be resetted, it uses this idempotency in the Kafka topic with compaction. So the topic itself must be compacted, and the producer must always create for the same data it sees the same key. And then that together works as there will be only one instance of this thing left in the Kafka topic, because when I produce it, idempotency and compaction is on, even if I have two of the same with an hour difference in my topic, but they have the same ID, the compaction of Kafka will make it one record.
Only the last one.
You checked it, right? You were debugging it last year somewhere, somehow.
Yeah, I wanted so that it's only the first one, but you said it's only the last one.
I said, or we checked? Because if I said it, it might be wrong. But if we checked, I should have t-shirts.
But
So to sum it up, the source and sync operators must also like participate in this checkpointing. And if they do, then you can really have exactly once.
And this checkpointing is just that the job manager shims in or puts in an additional item in the flow and says, okay, now checkpoint?
Yeah, they do it exactly in that way. There's also works, but in the end, they add like a new message, a control message to the normal data flow. And if the operator gets this control message, it knows now I should checkpoint that. And then it just saves the local state and it somehow remembers what was this last message. And then it goes on to the next operator does this until to the sync operator. And if all did that, then the job manager knows this state is now checkpointed and I can go back to this state.
Yeah. So if this token, let's say, went through the complete system, then you know that everyone on the way checkpointed.
Yes. And then you can recover.
Yeah.
And it's also very like, first of all, it goes with the normal data flow, so they don't have a special thing for that. It's just like it's data flowing through all the chains, like every data flows. And it's also very performant. It costs almost no performance to do that. And but now I cannot tell you the details about this. But
if you breach out, you have like nested JSON, and from the nested JSON, you create another data object that goes back to another operator. Mm-hmm. Is it checkpointed twice then? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, but it will then be used in a different processing way. So if you say, I want to have the frequency, like I have a JSON blob and there is a message field, and I want to have the term frequency over the message field, and then you say, now I'm interested in the hostname field of that log file, and you resend that data set again and computing the term count for the hostname then that will be a different computation and a different checkpointing, because that's a different computational flow.
Yeah, but that's a different job, basically. Okay, cool.
And usually these checkpoints are taken every couple of seconds. You can configure this. You can also disable it, but they recommend not to do it because it costs almost no performance and it gives you a lot of benefits. Yeah. So usually you would, like, every, I don't know, 30 seconds, you would have a checkpoint for your data. Then if your job crashes, then you can just restart it and say the job, tell the job, okay, please restart from this last checkpoint. Yeah. This is then called a save point.
Okay.
But the save point is just a special kind of checkpoint where you can restart from.
Okay, cool. Yeah. What's next?
I would be, so, I mean, we talked about what partitioning means. We didn't talk so much about capacity. Consistency is kind of where we just talked about. So yeah. You need to define this job in Flink from beginning to end, and everybody needs to participate in doing the proper checkpointing way. So you could get this delivery semantics, which gives you also then the consistency for that job. So that should be it. What to write was basically, I don't know. Capacity planning. I guess no one actually on the table did something for Flink in that regard. No. So you cannot do it, and Flink sucks.
I just know that Alibaba, I think it's the biggest Flink customer, and they have a Flink cluster with at least 1,000 or maybe some thousands nodes, and have state which is a couple of terabytes. So it seems that it works also in very huge environments, but I cannot tell you anything about capacity.
I think how would you write Flink jobs? They definitely, I know these guys were doing Scala before. Do you have Java APIs, or everything is Thrift, and then it doesn't matter which language you need? Or
so they have a Java API, Scala API. They also had a Python API. Experiment does not really support a lot of things. I don't know the current state of that, but yeah, Scala and Java.
Okay.
Oh, they still have documentation regarding Python.
Okay.
But they call it R. They call it beta. It's in beta.
Yeah.
But isn't it long time? Like this Python API thingy. I think I heard 3 years ago from.
Yeah. I think it always depends on the the priorities, and this has not a huge priority. I mean, Flink is a community-driven project, and you can give proposals and everything. But I think the highest priority for them are the stream processing features, to really have a strong stream processor, and that's where they focus on. I think it just has not the highest priority.
The other part is like only for certain I think what the big data batch people always did was analytics across huge data sets. So there is still this kind of like a part of the all overall community for Spark, Flink, and also Kafka is analytics people. And analytics people have a high preference to program in Python. I think that's fair to say. So do you want to expose your APIs also to be able to work with Python people? I mean, Spark does that also, and it's because they have these scientific libraries, and it's a little bit more handy to write. I mean, Python is just more trivial to write and shorter, and you get
trivial. He said trivial.
I mean,
you don't have to think so much. You don't fight Daniel against a very complex type system, but.
Yeah,
for other things, it's just not so applicable, I think.
So one thing just to point out, so Flink is a stream. So because before we said Spark is actually a batch processor, which can also be used for stream processing by doing micro batches. So Flink is exactly the opposite. So the core of Flink is a stream processor, but you can also do batch processing in a way that you have a bounded stream. So it's like a special kind of stream which has a start and the end. That's how they do batch processing. And then they also have libraries for machine learning and graph processing on top of Flink. But in this, like if I would do something like that, like graph processing or machine learning, I think that Spark has a lot of more libraries, support, community integration. So Flink has all this stuff, but it's compared to Spark, it's really small, I would say. So the main, so you can do these things with Flink, but Spark has the better support. So I would suggest Flink if you really need a strong stream processor, but I would not suggest Flink if you want to do a batch processing, graph processing, machine learning, then I would recommend Spark.
And I mean, as I understood, and I never used it, but Spark or Storm, I think it was Storm, that if you want to update one little item in your big topology, then you had to kill the whole thing and start it up again. Is it for Flink easier to, let's say, I have this little job facet that I want to update, can I just do it like that and then it will be updated?
So the way you would do that is, so let's say you have a running stream, like you have your application and you want to add a new operator, like do a new calculation. So you have your stream and you would take a save point from the stream, which is a special kind of checkpoint, but you just, it's a save point because you can restart from it. So now you have the save point, you shut down your stream, you deploy your new stream application, and but you start this new stream application from your last save point. And then Flink can assign the state to the existing operators, and the new operator, well, doesn't have state, but it will just catch up. Yeah. So that's possible.
Okay.
But it's also not so easy, easy maybe not, but so you have to take care about this assigning operators to a given name. So if you do that and you write your application, usually you have to provide a name to your operator that on the restart, Flink can assign again the state to the operator. So It's you have to do some programming around that. But
so I think what reminds me is here is the, like, how you would use Protobuf or Avro when you evolve schemas. You can change stuff, yes, but when you change stuff, you need to be really sure that you are not breaking anything, because some thing before you already relies on something. So for instance, you cannot like rename the ID field into my awesome ID and then expect that everything still is identifiable with the same ID. And I think the same goes for Flink. You can, this is my click streaming application and it's awesome, and now the intern has worked 3 years in his internship and came up with a new thing, and you just swap it and nobody has checked back what is what, then this is a too much of a change to have a stream processor updatable. That doesn't work that way.
So if you want to update a specific operator, that's a hairy idea. So like,
no, I think you like what Lars really said is basically you need to now have your computation and your stream of data. You need to think about both. What does the data still look like? What did I do already? What are the, like, the streaming job itself creates data, save points, intermediate results, and blah, blah, blah. And they all have a naming structure now. And if you're not recognizing it, stuff will break. But if you be careful and, like, do small updates to an already existing thingy by keeping the names. I mean, it's a little bit tedious, I think, because they... You don't want to have a system where you say somebody named my processor blah 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 blah, and then I came along and didn't know about that because the guy left the company, and now I didn't do the name blah 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 but blah 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 bloop. Then it's annoying to need to be in the know of a certain string someone else used somewhere, and that's fragile to me. But on the other hand, the trade-offs are basically you want to, now you have an updatable application with this conventions, and then that's kind of the contract you have to live with.
Yeah. Okay.
Cool. I think, can I rant?
Sure. Go ahead.
What I really think is the ironic here is like they use the most sophisticated GVM type system, writing everything in Scala, and then the update procedure relies on string oriented programming. By like completely throwing out of the window like that, like no type system will help you here. But that's the irony. Basically, the stuff in Flink is all safe and super duper. But, right? There are boundaries. And I like that irony. I think we are talking for a whole lot now.
Yeah.
Maybe we should find an end.
Yeah. Okay.
Are we?
But
do we still want to talk about this Kafka Stream stuff? Or?
I think it's the next podcast. We have to invite you again.
Again.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh no.
Oh no. So why are we not rich then?
I think you are.
Oh yeah, cool. Okay, why you are, why are the losers not rich?
The family takes so much money. No, that would be unfair. No, that refers back to this to a guy who was saying that we as developers should be paid like super like football soccer superstars.
Uh huh.
Because we like, if you are really an expert in your field, what you leverage, what you can give a company and make the company save money, you should get the money partially. And that would be most often millions, actually. So we should all be millionaires. That's the anecdote I want to slip in.
Okay. You should be paid by the real benefit you have for the company.
Yeah, but here's the thing.
Lately, economic value you bring to the company.
Yeah. And I came across somewhere a bank actually were using stream processing to do fraud detection on their credit card transactions. So all of their customers have credit cards and they do transactions and then they want to do fraud detection. And they had a very simple system in place where you are completely on the opposite side of the world. Is this transaction valid? And then they would give it to a pool of people who would go manually and do queries against the database and see what's common for this customer. Is it an uncommon case or a common case? So basically, what's that? The anomaly detection algorithm kicks in, and if you do it near real time and you maybe do some machine learning where you say all these village people never actually leave the country, so for their people, for these class of people, it's an outrage that the credit card gets charged from south of whatever another country because they are not leaving the area, but this is a business customer who is always on the plane, that's not an outlier here, and they were saving themselves. Of course, they could now fire 10,000 people in their bank to not go over anomaly detection, and they save millions of dollars. And now the ethical question comes in: who is getting the money? The guy who has not have the job anymore, the guy who make them lose the job—that's the programmer—or the one who will get the money in the end—that's the manager. So what's fair?
No, here. The shareholders get the money.
The shareholders?
Yeah.
And so everybody who lost his job got shares while he was fired.
No. Yeah, so you have like 5-10 rich people owning the bank and they will get richer and the rest will just not get fired because there were so much layoffs. So they say, we just fired 10,000 guys. The remaining 500... You're really sure you won the race?
Yeah.
I mean,
you can get fired too soon.
You get, yeah.
So, let's and just now keep we the are money. At capitalism tips.
Okay.
Nice lead in.
What is a capitalism tip?
I thought you had something new that we should buy. I was just, it was a random guess that you have something new in your pile of stuff. Actually, when we are in your apartment, because we are now in your apartment, I don't see any pile of stuff from, where did you left all this stuff? There's no Konrad. I was expecting like a big pile of old electronics, but here's none.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have time, actually. That's the problem. I have new business cards, but I didn't pay for them, so that's not really true.
And that doesn't do any good for capitalism. Because as a backgrounder, we always try to give, like, save capitalism.
Yeah, I try hard, but I failed the last couple of weeks. Yeah. I bought tickets for Foo Fighters.
You just saw Foo Fighters on Lollapalooza.
Yeah, but it's like next year, summer or so. And one ticket costs 100 euros. So that's basically capitalism.
But I mean, you bought a new Mac and you bought a new screen just a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
So, I mean...
So, buy a new MacBook. That can set you back a couple of thousand euros. Yeah, that's fine.
That's not new. That we spoke about that already.
But it's not new.
I was thinking about a new iPhone, but I'm still not sure.
Yeah, let's talk about the new iPhone. Tech news. So, yeah. You want to get the credit card information of an X iPhone X user, what do you need to do now? You just slap him in the balls, not in the face, and then you show his face into the iPhone X. It will unlock it, and you get the credit card information. That's really handy of Apple to give you.
Can you display the credit card information? Because normally you have to put in the PIN for such informations.
And then you just show him another time the face, and you get to the PIN because there are no PINs anymore.
Sure, there's a PIN. I mean, it's the same with Touch ID. When you first started up,
but there's
you need
no Touch ID on an iPhone X.
Yeah. Okay. But I'm not sure that this conversation goes somewhere.
No, I just want to I'm not buying an iPhone X. That's basically what I was trying to say.
What conferences are you guys going?
No, that is not about conferences. This is about, does anybody on the table knows about a calendar that you can subscribe to, which will give you, I don't know, 2 months in advance, like, there will be this awesome conference. Now, pack your bags, ask your manager if you can go, and not go, oh, the new videos from Conference X are out. That's too late.
Yeah. No, I don't know.
No, true. Maybe but there should be one.
We should start a company.
Maybe that's like good get rich fast.
That might like be the missing piece in the millionaires.
Calendar.
Get the most
conference
sophisticated
calendar. Conference calendar. Sorry.
Speaking calendar, yeah.
And then with, it sounds like a good idea.
I mean, there is one, but it was very Node.js heavy. So there are a couple of calendars on the web, but none really that I liked.
Okay.
I think, it's a Sunday evening.
Yeah. Afternoon.
It's cold in Germany.
Let's wrap it up. So we talked about Flink. We talked about
the history of stream and batch processors.
Yeah.
We got a guest. We didn't talk all along. The jokes were mediocre. That's my fault. I take that. And
my nose is still a little bit damaged.
Yeah.
But next time we promise
and
better.
We are totally not making a podcast a week.
Yeah, because last week I was out.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think we should just be honest and say we do a podcast when we do a podcast.
Yeah, but we try once a week.
Yeah, but
that's a tight schedule.
It's stressful.
Yeah.
And I can tell you that during Christmas and New Year's, there won't be the time to do a podcast every week.
Yeah, but how about a little bit optimism? How about a little bit optimism?
Yeah, we are trying to deliver a podcast quick.
Yeah,
often.
Let's bi-weekly. Let's say bi-weekly at least.
We try hard.
Yeah, we try hard. Okay. Cool.
And then the next
thanks
time,
Lars for joining. And
yeah,
as
thank
said,
you,
we,
Lars.
We will
thank you
invite you back
me.
And I will bring Hagen to drag you. Or maybe I can visit as well. And yeah, and then talk to you next time. And thanks to guys listening to our podcast.
I don't know if they actually listening it.
Anymore? Oh, but they better do.
We need to do more Twitter announcement and marketing.
Okay, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.